This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we've got a special edition of the show today as we bring you a one-hour forum with Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker. He joins us in the studio today, and Governor Baker, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
Now, I have to
on
say,
a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day. Thank goodness, finally, right? And this, by the way, this conversation with the governor is part of our joint coverage of this political season hosted by WBUR, the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston, and the Boston Globe. And to that effect, with me to co-host today's conversation is Joshua Miller, political reporter for the Boston Globe. Hi there, Josh.
Hi, Meghna.
And listeners, we want to hear from you this hour. What are your questions for Governor Baker about his first term in office? What would you like to see from his administration if he is to win a second term? And are you happy with the governor's leadership thus far? What else would you like to see? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston.
Governor, let's start with guns. Both chambers of the legislature recently passed versions of a so-called red flag bill, which would give courts the authority to temporarily strip weapons from individuals who have been identified by their families or roommates or romantic partners as a danger to themselves or others. If this gun control bill comes to your desk, will you sign it into law?
Well, we have a standing policy, which we've talked to you about before, which is we don't usually comment on the specifics of a particular piece of legislation, especially one that has differing versions in the House and the Senate. But I have said since this debate began that we are conceptually in favor of this concept and this notion and this sort of a law. And I think it actually builds on, in many ways, some of the more important and successful elements of the gun laws we have in Massachusetts already. I say to people a lot, including people in other states, that one of the things that's unique about the gun laws in Massachusetts is you can't get a license to carry in Massachusetts without getting permission from your local police chief. And that's the person who, in many respects, has the most interest in ensuring the safety of his or her community. And by the way, under current law, that police chief, if somebody comes to them and says that they believe their family member is going through a tough period and something bad may happen, that police chief has the authority right now, and it's been exercised on a number of occasions, to revoke their gun license and to confiscate their weapons for some period of time. And then that person has a 10-day window to go to court to make a case to appeal it. So,
Governor, can I just jump in here for a second? I'm so sorry. But to the point that you just made, then why do we need this new legislation?
Well, I was going to say, in some respects, what the police chiefs have said, and their voice on this matters a lot, is that they think this process, the process that requires somebody, first of all, I think the universe of people who can raise a concern is broader than it is under the current statute.
That's right.
Point number one. Point number two, a number of police chiefs have said, look, I would like to have some sort of a court-based process on this. In some respects, I think some of them feel that being the sole decision maker on this is something that does at times make them uncomfortable. And I've had a bunch of them say, I would rather have this happen as part of a court process, and they're happy to participate in whatever way makes sense.
Yeah.
And as I said, there's a little there are some differences between the two bills. I fully expect they'll work those out. The House and the Senate have talked about trying to get this done without naming a conference committee, which is usually code for we're going to try to move this in a relatively quick period of time. And as I said at the beginning, you know, we've already said conceptually that we support this type of thing.
Well, so opponents, though, of the bill are calling it, you know, basically a gun grab disguised as a public safety legislation. And I just want you to hear Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League of Massachusetts. I mean, he says that the temporary seizure could become a de facto permanent seizure and therefore, he believes, violate Massachusetts residents' Second Amendment rights.
Even if that order is lifted, you as a police chief, are you ever going to give that person their license back? I can never foresee that happening in the state of Massachusetts.
Do you want to respond to that?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is that under current law, as it stands now, that police chief has the authority right now to remove your license, to take away your weapons for some period of time. And as I said, there's a court process involved with respect to getting it back. And that, I would argue, has worked well. And I've been in office for 3 years, and I can't remember anybody showing up saying that that their rights with respect to this issue had been violated because a police chief wasn't willing to to give them back their weapons if they'd been involved in this type of a circumstance. And the other thing I would point out, and I can't emphasize this enough, Massachusetts has the lowest gun death rates on a per capita basis of any state in the country. And I think the gun laws we have here have demonstrated over time that they work. And I would also argue that this process, in some respects, creates more judicial representation than the one we have now. Right now, a police chief,
right,
on their own can remove your license and take away your weapons. And then you go to court to appeal that and try and get them back. Under this proposal, in both versions, what you're talking about is a process where you would actually go to court to make the decision about removing their license and confiscating their weapons.
So, Governor, it's interesting to hear what your thoughts about the effectiveness of Massachusetts gun laws right now, because I'm just wondering how that compares to, play a little bit of tape here, of back in 2013 when you sat down with Jim Browdy, who was then on NECN, and you expressed some skepticism about federal assault weapons ban, possibly also the Massachusetts assault weapons ban. I just want to play a tape here. This is, again, from 2013, where Browdy asked you what you made of the federal ban.
We have an assault weapons ban in Massachusetts.
And?
We've had it since 1998, Jim, and gun crime has gone up since then by a lot.
But New Hampshire doesn't have one.
If I thought it would solve the problem, I'd be all for it.
So as of today,
I need to see the evidence.
As of today, you're not in support of a federal assault
ban. I would like to see the evidence.
But you're not in support of it today.
Until I see the evidence, it says it would change. It would make a difference.
Is that still your view in 2018?
No, the evidence is overwhelming in support of it, which is why I support it. And I supported it in 14 when I ran as well. And I've also supported a ban at the federal level as well. And by the way, for a long time, we were the only state that passed legislation which I signed, which I asked for, to ban bump stocks, which are the mechanism that were used in the terrible shooting in Las Vegas to turn what was a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon. There are several other states since then that have done something similar, but I think the evidence on this stuff is pretty overwhelming.
But forgive me. I mean, that tape was from 2013, and you said that if you thought it would solve the problem, you'd be all for it. I need to see the evidence. I mean, what more evidence has come up between 2013 and now that's, I don't know, changed your mind? Or I'm just not clear about the difference in the evidence here. Because you said then that if you hadn't yet seen the evidence.
Well, the evidence is that we have the lowest gun death rates in the country. We also have an assault weapons ban. We've also been very successful from my point of view, in implementing and executing on the gun laws we have. And as I said, when the incident took place in Vegas, I was one of the first people to call for banning bump stocks. And I've said that to many of my colleagues in other states as well. I think it's perfectly fine for somebody to change their mind based on data.
Your opponent in the
Republican... In fact, I wish a lot more people in public life would do that.
Your opponent in the Republican primary, Pastor Scott Lively of Springfield, describes himself as, quote, 100% pro-Second Amendment. Do you?
I certainly support the Second Amendment, and I don't believe anything that we've done here in Massachusetts violates that. I think the vast majority of the gun laws that we have in Massachusetts create processes that ensure that people who have a license to carry in Massachusetts and have the ability to buy firearms are people who have been trained and gone through the requisite requirements associated with that and been signed off on by, as I said, their local police chief. And I think that's a good thing. I wish most other states work like that.
Earlier this week, a Somerville parent tweeted a photo of a poster made by a kindergarten teacher with instructions for what to do during a lockdown drill written to the tune of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Lockdown, lockdown, lock the door, shut the lights off, and say no more. Do you think our schools here in Massachusetts are as safe as they can be from mass shooters?
You know, every school district in Massachusetts is required to have a school safety plan. And an element of that school safety plan is something that deals with this particular issue. And different districts pursue different strategies to deal with this. In some cases, it has to do with points of egress. In some places, it has to do with windows and doors. In some places, it has to do with school resource officers. But I would argue that that process, what we probably ought to be doing as a Commonwealth is providing people with more guidance with respect to the things that seem to be working most effectively and encourage people to pursue those.
So you think there's a role for Massachusetts to tell school districts more?
I think Well, one of the things we proposed to do in on the opioid issue, for example, was there are a lot of different programs going on in schools across the Commonwealth right now to educate kids and parents and coaches and athletes about the dangers associated with opioids and opioid addiction. There are a lot of them. And one of the things we've been doing is putting together an inventory of all of them. And what we want to do is try to help school districts make decisions about which ones seem to be more effective than others, which ones are most appropriate for middle school kids, which one works best for high school kids. And I think on the school safety stuff, we probably ought to be more aggressive about supporting sort of a dissemination of information about the things that school districts seem to think work best.
Now, Governor Josh mentioned Scott Lively, so you're going to love this next question. Scott Lively has enough signatures to secure a spot on the ballot for the Republican gubernatorial primary in September. As you know, he earned 28% of the vote of Mass GOP convention of delegates. Will you debate him?
Well, I've said for a while now, and I'm going to continue to say that for the next 6 weeks or so, my primary focus is going to be on the end of the legislative session, where we have all kinds of things that are really important, we believe, to the Commonwealth that are currently pending. And I really want to spend my time and my effort and my energy on worrying about that legislation, closing out this fiscal year, opening the books for the next fiscal year, and basically doing my job.
Yeah. So
and once we get to the end of that, we can talk about Scott Lively.
Okay.
Although there are a lot of things about Scott Lively that, especially a lot of his positions with respect to the LGBTQ community, that I find a bit appalling.
Are you going to the Pride parade this weekend?
I'm actually going to be in Western Mass tomorrow,
okay.
But I did make sure that I was down there for the flag raising,
okay.
Which is a great event.
So I take your point about, you know, staying focused on matters left unsettled regarding this legislative session. But I mean, those 28% of Mass GOP delegates were definitely trying to send you a message loud and clear. And I just want to play some tape here. This is Mary Lou Daxlin. She's president of the conservative Massachusetts Republican Assembly, not officially affiliated with the Mass GOP. She was one of the Lively, one of the delegates who voted for Lively at the convention. We spoke with her shortly after that, and here's what she said.
There is such a split in the Republican Party right now in Massachusetts over the fact that Charlie Baker is running basically in more line with the Democrat platform. Okay, Governor Baker, you're the most popular governor supposedly in the country as a Republican. We don't want you as the nominee.
I mean, I get it that you don't necessarily want to talk about Scott Lively's presence in the primary right now, but those voters are out there. I mean, what's your response to someone like Mary Lou Daxlund?
Well, you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion. That's the great thing about democracy. But I got 72% of the vote at the convention, which I was honored to have from people who, in many cases, I've known and worked with over the long course of my professional and political career. And I look forward to having a chance to engage in a aggressive campaign. But I really look, it's hard enough to get people with all the stuff that's going on to focus on the work that we need to get done in the next 6 weeks. And we have a really important opioid bill. We have a really important housing bill. We have an important environmental bill, economic development bill, two budgets. I mean, there's a lot going, criminal justice reform legislation that we'd like to be able to implement. We have a lot to do, and I'm really going to focus on that.
I want to just
I don't
drill
think Mary Lou voted for me in 2010 either.
Yeah. So just forgive me. I'm going to drill down on this a little bit because I think, you know, a governor of your capacity and capability who also has an active campaign going, yes, can say that you want to focus on the what the legislature and you have yet to finish. But there is a campaign going on. And I just wonder why you're not willing to say whether or not you're going to debate Lively even after the legislative session is over, because I keep thinking there are a million Massachusetts voters who voted for Donald Trump. There's folks like Mary Lou Daxlund out there. They're actively saying you have not satisfied them as a Republican, and you know they have put a very right wing Republican on the ballot because of that. You're gonna have to grapple with that at some time. And I'm just wondering why it seems like right now you don't want to do that.
Look, I think my job as governor of the Commonwealth is to do my job, and I intend to continue to do it. I think that's part of what the voters appreciate about our administration generally, is we tend to try to be as focused on the work and a little less on the partisanship and the point scoring that a lot of other people are focused on. And in this particular case, we have 6 weeks left in the session. There's a lot going on, and a lot of this stuff is really important, and I've been working on it in some cases for almost 2 years. And I would like to see it through and see it get accomplished, and I don't want to get distracted at this point in time by other stuff. And there'll certainly be time to engage in the debate and the discussion around the primary, just as there will be time to engage in the same debate if we're fortunate enough to win the primary in the general election. And that's how it should be.
Agreeing to a debate would be distracting?
I just think for now I'm going to focus on my day job. And I think, frankly, I think that's where most people would want us to be.
You know, Governor, I'm going to let this go after this, I promise. But I have talked to Scott Lively.
You can talk about it all day,
no,
if you want.
Well, I mean,
and I'll keep saying the same thing.
Well, because there's the question of what it means to be a Republican now. I mean, we had someone send us a question who wonders, why is it that you're a Republican in 2018?
Well, let's start with the fact that I think both parties on the edges, and let's face it, Scott Lively is on the edge of the Republican Party, don't like it when people who are part of their team collaborate with people on the other team. That's just a fact. And it's as true on the Democrat Party side as it is on the Republican side. And I think it's one of the biggest shames we face when it comes to public discourse and public action. Look at Washington. It's almost impossible to come up with anything that anybody's done on a bipartisan basis down there in a really long time. And I take a lot of pride and a lot of satisfaction in the fact that most of the major pieces of legislation that have been passed in the last 3 years have been passed with the votes of both Republicans and Democrats, including the ERPO legislation that we were both just talking about. That got a majority of both Republicans and Democrats in the House and in the Senate. And I think people, for the most part, want us to work together, want us to collaborate, and want us to work on behalf of the people of the Commonwealth. Now, I've also said many times that I think constructive friction is a good thing. And I think having a Republican as a candidate, as an opponent in the corner office, in the legislature, in a statewide office, teeing up against a Democrat is a good thing, as long as people understand and appreciate that we're all supposed to be in the business of listening to the people of Massachusetts and making the best decisions we can. And I would argue that that constructive friction has a lot to do with why we've had success on so many issues here in Massachusetts and why we've had, for the past few years, more people working than any time in state history. But I have no problem. I mean, I really grew up politically and professionally working for Bill Weld and Paul Cellucci, who were two of my mentors in the 1990s. And that kind of Republicanism, which is very consistent with sort of this region in New England generally. I talk to Senator Susan Collins all the time about stuff. She's a very similar kind of Republican as well.
But it's totally out of step with the national GOP right now. That's the thing.
I'm not running for national office. I'm the governor of the Commonwealth of Mass. And my job is to represent the interests of the people of Massachusetts.
I want to ask you about something in national politics. What do you think there are three things that Donald Trump has done so far in office as president that have moved the country forward in positive ways?
Well, I certainly hope that, and this one sort of like a maybe, is I would love to see the debate, which I think is going to take place either this week or probably next week in Washington, around federal policy with respect to opioid addiction is going to go somewhere. I put a lot of time in on that opioid commission along with Governor Roy Cooper from North Carolina and former Congressman Pat Kennedy from Rhode Island and a bunch of other people to build a case for a federal policy around the opioid issue nationally. And a bunch of the things we've done here in Massachusetts were part of that, but other people also came up with a lot of good ideas as well. And the president's budget did include an increase in spending ultimately on a variety of those initiatives. There, Senator Warren has a proposal out there. There's Hal Rogers, who's been huge on this issue in the House.
Congressman from Kentucky.
Right. Has a ton of issues, has a ton of proposals on this. And I hope that one of the things we get out of this is going to be a much bigger role for the federal government in dealing with the opioid addiction. That would be one. And I've said several times that if he can actually come up with a program that helps us create some kind of framework for peace with North Korea, that would be a huge win for the world. Now, that's a hope. But the mere fact that they actually created a date on which they were going to get together, and Secretary of State Pompeo has been over there a couple times, and there does seem to be some positive momentum on that. I mean, that would be a really good thing for the world overall. And I guess the third thing I would say is I think the discussion that's taking place around trade, while I disagree vehemently with a number of elements of what the Trump administration's proposing, I think the discussion about trade is a worthwhile one. And I say that in part because when I talk to a lot of people I know in the heartland of America, the middle part of the country, they certainly feel that trade policy, and they have some very specific examples. The furniture industry is probably the best one, where they believe U.S. trade policy really did a lot of damage to their local economies.
Mm. Well,
which is not to say I'm a big fan of a lot of his positions on many other things, because I'm not.
To that point, I just want to ask you quickly about the Trump administration's policy of separating children from migrants, their migrant parents who arrive at the border seeking asylum. What's your take on that?
I think it's a terrible policy. And the thing that bothers me the most about it is I think it's been a policy of this country for a while, based on a lot of the back and forth I've seen. I think it's being pursued a lot more aggressively now, but some of the news reports I've seen on that date back several years, which is even more troubling. I've been saying for a long time that this is a great example of an issue where the fact that Republicans and Democrats can't get together and create a bipartisan approach to rational immigration reform is a human tragedy in so many ways. And I've been saying that for 4 or 5 years now. And the end result of that is just a lot of really bad actors doing a lot of bad things.
Well, we are talking with Governor Charlie Baker. You're listening to WBUR's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, along with the Boston Globe's Joshua Miller. This is a special conversation hosted by WBUR and our consortium members, the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston and the Boston Globe. If you have a question for Governor Baker, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And Governor, there's a lot more ground that we want to cover, but Josh has got some good questions from people who've written into us.
Listeners have written in. Alexander Hoyt asks online, what achievement are you most proud of that you think would not have been achieved had you not been elected in 2014?
I have to pick one. I'm not kidding. I mean, there's a lot of good work this administration's done that I'm very proud of.
What's the first one that comes to mind?
Well, the first thing is the success we've had so far in dealing with the opioid epidemic. I really do believe that our administration had a lot to do with putting this issue on the front burner and engaged a lot of people in this debate. And the legislation we got passed, which passed, by the way, unanimously, everybody voted for it, was a very significant and important first step that really put treatment, recovery, prevention, and education front and center. And literally after a decade of nothing but double-digit increases in deaths and overdoses and prescriptions, in 2017, for the first time in a very long time, we actually saw a drop in the number of deaths in Massachusetts, a very significant drop in prescriptions, and for the first time, a leveling out in the number of overdoses. Now, we have a second piece of legislation on the opioid issue called the CARE Act, which is currently pending before the legislature. And it's one of the things I really want to see happen between now and the end of the session, because it contains a number of elements that I think are critical to continuing to pursue the progress that we've had so far. But I say that recognizing that we have a really long way to go on this one. And I'll give you one example of how this whole issue just continues to morph over time. If you go back and look at the death data, I can't even believe I'm saying that. If you go back and look at the death data from 2013 and 14, fentanyl was present in about somewhere between 15 and 20% of the deaths in Massachusetts. In 2017, it was present in over 80% of the deaths. And the mere arrival of fentanyl and the possibility of carfentanil and some other synthetic forms of opioids just raises all kinds of alarm bells about the fact that we have a long way to go before we're going to get to where we need to be on this one.
One other question from a listener, Glenn Berkowitz asks, what two things would you give yourself a grade of C or D and a needs improvement?
C or D or needs improvement.
Where have you fallen short?
Oh, I can think of plenty of places where we've fallen short. I guess I would say that while I'm pleased with the progress we've made on the MBTA, we have a long way to go there. We're going to spend about $8.5 billion over the next 5 years. It's the single biggest 5-year investment by a mile ever in the public transportation system. Most of it's going into the core system, which is where I believe we should have been spending our money historically. And I believe it will do a lot of things. It will significantly increase the system's capacity, hundreds of thousands of new seats. It will dramatically improve the system's reliability and dependability. And I think that will significantly enhance and encourage people's interest in riding it. But I would give myself I would give us as an administration a needs improvement on that one. I think the second thing I would point to is it's not really I'll give us a C or a D on this. We were working with the Group Insurance Commission, which is the entity that manages health insurance benefits for state employees and retirees and their families, very aggressively to. They'd been dealing with year after year after year of really significant increases in premiums, and people were very upset about that. And we did a whole bunch of things to we recontracted the pharmacy system. We did a bunch of things. And those things all did a great job of reducing the run rate. But one of the other things that we simply didn't do a good job of processing was how many plans people wanted available to them. And we reduced the number of plans and discovered at that point in time that we had not communicated this effectively to much of anybody. And the blowback on it was intense. And, you know, the good news is we eventually, after a few really tense days of realizing that we had gotten way out over our skis, we pulled it all back and we didn't do that. But clearly in that particular case, we did a terrible job of knowing our customer and communicating with them. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to get to a call here for a second, but I would just want to take a step backwards because I was fact-checking something about the Trump administration's policy on separating children and parents when they cross the border, because you had mentioned that that something like this had been going on for years. And it's a really sensitive topic, so I just wanted to – PolitiFact is saying here that referring immigrants for prosecution is not a new policy. But PolitiFact says that prior administrations did not enforce the practice the way the Trump administration has.
Okay, that's good to know.
That in general, families were detained together or sent back immediately, deported immediately, okay. or paroled into
good.
The country. But because of the Trump's...
Still a terrible policy.
Yeah, the Trump DOJ's policy of zero tolerance and immediate prosecutions is leading to the dramatic separation of 650 children from their parents in just a 2-week period. In May, and that is definitely something new for the United States. We've got a lot of callers here, so let's go to them. Pat is calling from Watertown. You're on the air, Pat, with Governor Baker.
Governor, thank you for your time. I have a two-part question, both around transportation. I would say, you know, many of us, certainly myself, feel that we have urgent infrastructure needs, both in the roads and on the T. How are we going to address them without more revenue sources? And the second half that don't involve raising T fares. And the second half is, should the state have a role in managing bike share and ride share, or should it be on a city or town by town basis? Thank you.
So let me start with the second one. I am a believer that, you know, I'm a local government guy. I served on my board of selectmen, so did the lieutenant governor. And we take very seriously this notion that one of our major objectives as a state government should be to leverage and support cities and towns so that they can be effective in serving their constituents. So on something like ride share and bike share, I'm more inclined to give the locals a lot of latitude. That said, one place where I believe we can be helpful, and we've tried to be helpful, and I believe we've made some significant progress, is by helping communities connect a lot of their trails. One of the most interesting things, or most frustrating things, someone might say, about the way all of our walking paths and our bike paths are organized in Massachusetts is a lot of them just don't connect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're putting a lot of money into connecting a lot of the ones that don't connect, so that on some of the routes where if we connect two or three different parts of the route, you take something that used to be sort of disjointed and difficult for somebody to ride from one end of it to the other, and making it possible for people to do that. And one of the ones, for example, we've been connecting is the Cape, where I think at this point you can get from Provincetown to Bourne on one ride. I think that's one place where we have real we have the maps, we know where the connections need to happen, and we are constantly engaging with the folks in local communities to see if we can help them connect a lot of these bike and ride paths together, so that people can go a very long distance on a bike or walking. And the other thing we can do with some of that is also end up connecting people to downtowns. We have a Complete Streets program, which we started, again, based on conversations with local communities, which makes it possible for local communities to partner with the state. We put our money up, they put some of theirs up, and they can do work to enhance both bike lanes and sidewalks and stuff like that in their local communities, especially around their downtown and retail and commercial sectors, so that people can actually get there by bike or they can walk, which in many cases they're not able to do. With respect to the road and T piece around revenue, we've put a tremendous amount of work into the core infrastructure of the public transportation system, and we've done thousands and thousands of miles of regrading and repaving roads in Massachusetts, enough to crisscross the state five times on the road piece. I would argue that at this point in time, we've made a fair amount of progress on this stuff. As I said earlier, I think we have a long way to go, but I don't believe at this point our solution to this is to raise revenue. I think our solution to this is to focus on the stuff that we've currently got underway and to follow through and deliver on it. And I'll give you one final example of this. When we took office, the Green Line Extension Project, which is a very important public transportation project into Somerville, it's been on the books forever, had gone from being sort of a $1.8 billion project to being a $3 billion-plus project by the time we took office. And it was no longer, it just wasn't going to happen. It was off the books. It was no longer affordable. The feds weren't going to put their $1 billion in to fund a $3 billion project. And we went back and re-engineered the whole thing, came up with a project that cost $2.3 billion instead of north of $3 billion, put $1 billion from us, $1 billion from the feds, and $300 million from the local communities, from Cambridge and from Somerville and from the Mass MAPC into it. And that project is underway. We're going to build the Green Line Extension. But if we had simply sort of sat on our hands and said, geez, we just have to raise more money, it wouldn't have happened. And the reason it happened was because we re-engineered the project to make it fit within the budget that had originally been structured for it.
So, Governor Baker, I'm actually glad that Pat brought up the issue of transportation, because in my mind, transportation is one of those places where the urgency of the needs of the Commonwealth right now actually give us a really strong sense as to why those needs become 10, 50, 100 times more urgent when you think about what the needs of the Commonwealth are going to be a decade out from now. And I guess that's my way of saying it's one place in which I think it's very justified to say, why isn't there a bigger vision for what we want to make in terms of our transportation system for the future, not just what we need now. And let me just play a little bit of tape here in terms of how urgent that question is, because just this week we talked with Travis McCready, whom you know well. He's the president and CEO of the Massachusetts Life Sciences sector. We talked with him about the $500 million initial investment that the Commonwealth wants to make in the life sciences. Great move. But here's what he told us about a really interesting finding from MassBio's annual industry survey from this year.
People expressed a willingness to choose where to live and choose perhaps not to live in the Commonwealth based on their commute time. That had not shown up before. Transportation, housing, these things are not nice to have, exogenous issues that, you know, don't affect the innovation economy. They're real.
I mean, in other words, vision, transportation is something that really could benefit from a big vision. So what's stopping you from offering something that's more than reform and repair of the system that we have right now?
Big vision does not equal tax increase, okay? I mean, I would argue that for a very long time, we mouthed all the words about a big vision, but didn't actually take care of business at home. The amount of time and effort that we had to spend as an administration after we took office to simply put the pieces back together again at the MBTA is extraordinary. We didn't have an asset management plan. We had a formula that people updated every year. But in terms of actually being in a position to make the kinds of capital investments that people wanted people to make in the T, we didn't have the data or the information to do that. We didn't have a capital delivery system in place that could actually do the kind of work that's required to upgrade the system and invest in its core. And I'll tell you something. Over the course of the next several years, we're going to increase capacity on the Red Line by 50%. The Red Line is the most important rapid transit system associated with what Travis was talking about. That's the one that runs through Cambridge and all the way out to North Quincy and beyond to Braintree. 50% increase in the Orange Line. Both of those increases are going to make a big difference with respect to that's part of the system's ability to deliver. But the other thing I would point out is if you just got the cars, which is all people were originally talking about, and you don't put the money into the signaling system and the switches and the rails and the electronics and the power systems, you don't get what you're supposed to get. So a big part of the investment on this is in all the stuff that's around the cars as well. We're currently working on a plan to update all of the cars on the Green Line, which will significantly increase by about another 50% the Green Line's capability. But to do that, we have to replace all the tracks on the Green Line, which we're doing on a pretty regular basis, practically every night.
I get it, Governor. I mean, like,
my vision is making the thing work. Making it reliable and dependable enough so somebody would get out of their car and take it because they believe it's going to get them where they need to go. And I would argue that when we took office, that was the biggest problem with the public transportation system. Not that it didn't go to enough places. The biggest problem was it wasn't very good at getting people to where they needed to go on the system that was already in place, and practically everything on the system was more than 50 years old, and it didn't work very well.
So you're saying that Massachusetts, regarding transportation, can't build for the future?
I am building for the future. That's my point. The first thing you need to do to build for the future is make sure the core system that moves a million people a day is reliable and dependable and gets them to where they want to go so that other people, as you increase the capacity of the system, 50% increase on the Red Line and the Orange Line is hundreds of thousands of riders. 50% increase in that capacity is a really big deal. But people aren't going to ride that capacity if you don't give them a reliable and predictable service can depend on.
When will Green Line, Orange Line, Red Line customers see a real difference in service? What month and year should they begin to expect that?
Well, the Red Line and Orange Line cars start landing at the end of this year and the beginning of next year, and will land continuously for the next several years. The Green Line cars start landing a couple years out after that.
So you expect better
service? I think there's just
going
to be a continuous upgrading of those three lines for at least the next 5 years, maybe even beyond that, maybe the next 10.
So, but fixing the T, can it not happen in conjunction or parallel to also thinking about you know, what will the system need to support 10 years from now? I mean, I'm thinking about the opportunity that I'm thinking about the opportunity that the state has with development in Alston, right? I mean, think about West Station. Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollock has said that that new station wouldn't open until or after 2040, after the I-90 viaduct project is getting finished. But what happened to the whole concept of, like, if you build it, they will come, or transportation, you know, oriented development, all these things that Massachusetts has been a leader on, we're not doing that for something like West Station.
We've probably done more transit-oriented development in the last 3 years than they did in the previous 8, okay? That's point number one. Point number two is there are two big thought pieces going on right now. One of them is being led by the former chief of staff to my administration, Steve Kadish, who is a futures commission on transportation, and it's supposed to be talking about 2040. And what he's really interested in, and what we should all be interested in, because remember, transportation investments are not for a year or two; they're like for 10 years, or 20 years, or 30 years. So you better get them right. What he's taking a look at is electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles, the grid, storage, and all the issues that come with that in terms of how people are actually going to get around. I mean, Tony Seba, who is a pretty well-known guy, who was here recently talking about the future of transportation, was saying he thinks in 5 to 7 years, a lot of people are going to start buying transportation as a service, mm-hmm. and they're not going to buy cars, and then autonomous vehicles are right around the corner. We really need to kick the tires on that, because if that's pun intended, because if that's really going to be where we're going to go and how this is going to work, it has huge implications for the decisions we make about what we invest in and how. The second one is Secretary Pollock's project on the T in 2040, which will probably be out sometime in the next, certainly be out this summer. And that's going to be an outline based on all the conversations they've had with people about how the stuff that's currently underway is going to land, what some of the next things to do are going to look like, and then what some of the stuff that looks like after that's going to look like based on where people are going to live. And you can toggle this mm-hmm. stuff. There'll be a bunch of different scenarios around where they think people are going to live, where they think they're going to work, and that's going to be a function of whether or not we get our housing bill and we're actually able to build enough affordable housing for people to be able to live in some of the places that they would like to live. But those two initiatives are going to be really important to the question you're asking, which is the vision for transportation. And as far as West Station's concerned, here's what I would say about that. The first thing is you can't build West Station tomorrow, because where the station goes is the staging area for the viaduct replacement. So if the viaduct replacement, and by the way, there's some debate about the viaduct replacement.
Right.
There's two options. One of them is you build one on top of the other because it's Storrow Drive, it's the turnpike, it's the commuter rail, it's potentially also rapid transit and a bike path and mm-hmm. a berm along Storrow, along the Charles yeah. River.
Or you put it all at grade, right?
Or you put it all at grade.
Yeah.
If you put it all at grade, it's literally like, it could be as much as 6 to 8 lanes of traffic and 3 to 5 rail beds. That's big. There's a lot of back and forth on it. The folks at the T have heard that. They're talking to people about it. And I anticipate that they're probably going to ask some outside experts to come help them think a little bit about what the right answer is on that. But that's a really big decision. You don't want to make the wrong one. The second thing is the city of Boston and Harvard and BU all have to be part of the conversation with the T around what that area is going to look like. What's the streetscape going to be? What's the where's the residential going to go? What's going to be research? What's going to be commercial? Is there going to be a third rail built that's going to carry not commuter rail passengers, but rapid transit passengers? Because mm-hmm. If you build the third rail, that has real implications for which option you choose with respect yeah. to the viaduct versus the building everything at grade. And it's our hope that those questions, which are big ones, are all going to get dealt with and addressed sometime in the next few months.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you something. we are willing to build West Station. We're also willing to build it before 2040. What I don't think we're willing to do is build it until some of these other questions get addressed so that we know what kind of West Station we're building. Is it one for commuter rail and bus transportation, or is it one for rapid transit, bus stations, commuter rail, and other forms as well?
Yeah. Well, I just want to say here quickly that you're listening to Radio Boston on WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I'm also here with Joshua Miller of the Boston Globe, and you're hearing us in conversation with Governor Charlie Baker, and this is in a consortium event with our consortium members, the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston and the Boston Globe.
Yeah. Since this is a consortium forum, Governor Baker, we have a question here from a professor at UMass Boston. It's Michael Johnson. He's the chair of the Department of Public Policy and Public Affairs at the McCormick Graduate School. And Professor Johnson is concerned about funding by the state for public higher education. Let's listen.
According to a Mass budget report, Massachusetts has cut higher education spending per student by 32% since fiscal year 2001. Indeed, Massachusetts ranks 45th in the U.S. according to higher education support per $1,000 of personal income. These trends overall have not shown much improvement during Governor Baker's time in office. Are you, Governor, satisfied with the level of state budget support for public higher education, and if not, what will you do to change the long-term trend of declining support that has continued in your administration?
What's your answer for the professor?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that I can't really speak to 2001 forward since I've only been here since 2015. I guess the second thing I would say is that the 45th per $1,000 of per capita income. I mean, so I'm not sure that's the right measure, and I'll tell you why. Most other states have a very different mix of public and private higher education than we do. And I think the right measure is the per student number. And I don't know what it is, and I don't know where we fit. But if I was looking for a measure that I would want to measure us against other states, I would pick what's our level of investment on a per-student basis relative to what other states invest.
Continuing on public ed.
Can I just finish? Yeah. We have increased spending for public higher ed. I think it's critically important that we continue to increase our spending in public higher ed. The other thing I think is really important, and I've seen this really work. I mean, we have early college programs that we've started that give kids who are not AP student kids, but kids who are trying to decide whether they should go to college or not, the ability to take college courses while they're still in high school with teachers they know, and it creates familiarity for them with some of the schools in their area. And that has made it possible for them to earn credits that make it possible for them to basically get them for free. I mean, one of the other things we've done is created a commitment program where if you start at a community college for 2 years in a whole bunch of areas, you can take all your credits, transfer to a state university or to UMass, and graduate for $30,000 for 4 years. And that's before you start talking about the cost of what you might be able to get in terms of student support, Pell Grants, scholarships, and that kind of thing. And I think the other thing we've tried to do is to create approaches to digital learning and giving kids the ability, especially people who are working, to access college educations on their time as opposed to having to access it on. Because a lot of people, if they're working or raising a family or something like that, they can take some of their stuff in a classroom, but some of it they need to be able to take when they can take it.
Speaking of higher education, do you have full confidence in Marty Meehan, the president of UMass?
I think President Meehan has a lot of work to do in mending the fences with UMass Boston, period. And I believe that he will. I think he did a terrific job at UMass Lowell. I've spent a lot of time up there. I've talked to a lot of people up there. They're incredibly pleased with the work that was done there. But there's clearly a big disconnect between the president's office and between UMass Boston, and he needs to work on that one.
Does he still have your full confidence?
Yeah.
Governor, we just got about 2 minutes left here, so I want to just ask you quickly about the state police, the Massachusetts State Police, because this week the state police linked 7 new troopers to alleged theft of overtime pay, bringing the total number of troopers under scrutiny to about 40. And I know that you did put forth a raft of some significant structural changes back in April to the state police. But I'm also wondering, what more do you think you or your administration can or should do to get to what feels like a deeper cultural issue about the at the state police, that there's this persistent feeling that they don't see themselves really as accountable to anyone?
I think the I think the whole story, especially with respect to Troop E, which is where the vast majority of these referrals to the Attorney General for potential criminal investigation came from, is a huge stain on the state police. And I say that as somebody who knows a lot of folks who are troopers and who go out there and do the right thing every day. And a lot of these folks who are working in human trafficking units and gang units and working with colleagues in local government on key investigations, they do great work. And they are absolutely worse off because of all this. And that's part of the reason why Colonel Gilpin decided to disband Troop E, because Troop E was clearly a big part of where this problem was taking place. And as a cultural issue, I can't think of a worse one. People who take an oath to enforce the law, who have the authority to arrest people if they break the law, engaging in what appears to be alleged activity where they were in fact stealing from the toll payers and the taxpayers. And the other thing I would say about this one
is... We've just got about 10 seconds,
okay,
Governor.
This state police has a lot of work to do. One of the things we've talked to the colonel about is getting an outside expert in to work with her and advisor on how to execute along some best practices pursuant to the Burke report, which was done in response to this whole catastrophe.
Well, Governor Charlie Baker, it's been a real pleasure. I look forward to having you join us again before September, so thank you so very much.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
And I also want to say thanks to Joshua Miller, political reporter for the Boston Globe, for being my co-host this hour. Josh, thank you so much.
Great to be here.
This is Radio Boston.